could have anticipated. How do you know all this? I said.
It is simply the business of the magic resistance to know everything that interests us. How we gather our information is of no consequence.
Oh, typical, said the wife. This is just because we got all this from my intelligence network. I bet if we'd found it out from that gaggle of drunks you call spies, you wouldn't miss an opportunity to blow their trumpet.
If we could return to the point.
Oh, you should have seen him, dear. When my girls dug up your death certificate, he went off and sulked in the attic with his silly train set for 3 hours.
It is not si-
The husband stopped himself and took a few calming breaths.
What we need to know is how Dreadgrave succeeded in resurrecting pre-infusion fatalities with their souls intact.
Why do you need to know that? I asked. Aren't there enough suicidal immortals around?
We don't intend to use it to resurrect our very own undead horde, if that's what concerns you. But Dreadgrave did what we had long thought impossible. He altered the status quo. He found a way to inflict the infusion upon those previously unaffected. If we can reverse-engineer his methods, perhaps we can also find a way to remove the infusion's effect.
I don't know how he did it, I confessed. He didn't tell us any of that. I just did guard duty, ran the rat pit, and sometimes managed the heads on spikes. I know how he did it. I stared at Merrill. Or rather, since I was still blinded from the spotlight, I looked vaguely in the direction her voice was coming from. A subtle movement of blurry shapes behind the light indicated that our two interrogators were doing the same. I was his first success. Worked as his lab assistant for a while. He didn't realize I had free will until after he raised all you guys in that cemetery. I was just easygoing, and he seemed so pleased with himself I didn't have the heart to say anything.
You know his method, went the husband.
Well, okay, I don't know, no, but I know that it had something to do with syndrome victims. He was always sending his men out to round them up from the big adventure towns. Then he'd make me chop them up and pick out the bits he wanted. That's how I learned anatomy.
You knew about the syndrome back then? I asked, flabbergasted.
All I knew was that we had to find attractive people in armor who ran everywhere in really straight lines and didn't talk much, and that he wanted me to cut out their eyes and brains.
Hey, he was probably after those things you found, said the wife.
Shh! Went the husband.
Don't you shush me, and why are we even keeping up the secrecy thing? They're obviously the right people.
Maybe if you weren't so quick to trust everyone, Carlos and Debbie wouldn't have been captured.
Well, maybe if you weren't so quick to not trust people, more of them would want to work for us. I'm just going to turn the lights on.
No!
There was a crackle of magic, and a set of lamps snapped on, replacing the spotlight. Now we could see that we had been brought into the main chamber of a vast cathedral, probably dating from around one of the sword's layers. A massive stained-glass window directly facing us had been broken in by the petrified roots of some massive tree from a slightly less ancient generation. A lot of the rubble and rotting furniture had been cleared away to make room for some magic-powered lighting, workbenches, cabinets, and the two chairs into which Merrill and I had been strapped. A corpulent woman on the far side of middle age was standing by a light switch, wearing a black robe with something of the cult about it, and a pair of gold-rimmed spectacles on a chain around her neck. Her husband was sitting on a large, high-backed leather chair just in front of us, and had swiftly pulled his hood over his head as the lights had come on. In the shadowed recesses of his face, something was glowing a malevolent red.
"Oh, don't be such a baby," said the woman. She smartly stepped over and tugged his hood back down. I yelped and fell backwards in my chair.
"Hey, I know you," said Merrill. "Dredgrave had a poster of you in his office."
It was Baron Sivius. He was easily recognizable from the picture of him I'd seen in the Children's Compendium of Incredibly Traumatizing Bedtime Stories, which had colored many a troublesome childhood night, usually piss yellow. He was close to 7 feet tall, and had the kind of absurdly slim build that you can only get from a liquid diet. Half his face was covered in an expressionless metal mask, and the other half was so thin that the cheekbone was poking out through the flesh. His eyes glowed red, as did several veins that crawled visibly beneath his chalk-white skin. Under his black robe, he was wearing what looked like a woolly cardigan in warm autumnal colours.
"Yes, all right. I am Baron Sivius," he said, noting my reaction. "Get up. You will not be harmed while you are potentially useful."
"He's all talk, really," said Mrs. Sivius, helping me up.
"Argle braggle," was all I could manage.
"I thought you were the Lord of the Malevolans," said Merrill. "Dredgrave was always talking about taking us there on a field trip some day."
Baron Sivius's face was already like thunder, but her question turned it into a 48-hour deluge with hailstones the size of cowpats.
"The Malevolans are now Fortune Valley. I refuse to work with the Adventurers' Guild, and they used their influence to displace me. My treacherous minion Wormgob now rules in my place."
"Now, now," said Mrs. Sivius, "you were always the one who said the day Wormgob staked you in the heart would be the day he was ready to inherit your empire."
"If he'd done it out of his own initiative, I would have been satisfied. But the Guild paid him. He rules now as their puppet. Even then I wouldn't have minded if he'd had the balls to actually stake me in the heart. But this... early retirement..."
He said the last two words in the same way my dad would say, "those damn coloureds."
"Show them the things," said Mrs. Sivius.
Baron Sivius stood up from his seat, gathering his robe about him. Even the simplest of his actions was steeped in omen and dread. When he drew himself up to his full height, it was like watching someone solemnly raise a flag depicting the end of the universe. He beckoned us towards two of the workbenches, upon which lay two autopsied corpses. One was an albino from the tunnels, his stiffened fingers stuck in horrified claws that were probably something to do with the massive hole in the back of his head. The other was an adventurer. It was human, male, as bronzed as polished copper, and probably handsome before his features had been peeled off his face, so he was obviously a syndrome victim.
"We already suspected that there was a link between the syndrome and the infusion," said Sivius, waving a hand across the body, with the same kind of gesture he'd used to send a platoon of skeletal warriors into battle. "It was when we dissected the brains of the victims that we discovered something strange."
"There you go again, talking too much," said his wife, arms folded. "She already said Dredgrave knew about the brains. This is why everyone was so bored at our last dinner party."
Sivius shot a murderous glance at her.
"I could have been rid of you when you grew too old, woman. There will always be youthful beauties who would willingly surrender to my dark power."
"Yes, but none of them know how you like your porridge, do they?"
The Dread Lord unflinchingly inserted an emaciated hand into the adventurer's exposed brain.
It emerged holding what looked like a transparent rubber ball with a number of short, quivering tentacles. The inside was filled with green smoke that glowed softly from within. It was a similar shade of green to the crystals that had powered Dreadgrave's mass resurrection spell back in the cemetery, during those happy, innocent days that seemed so long ago.
"That's it," said Merrill excitedly. "Those are the things Dreadgrave was messing with."
Sivius held it to his uncovered eye, rocking it back and forth between thumb and forefinger.
"This is a chloroform's folly. It is an organ found within the brains of sentient creatures. But for centuries no scholar has been able to determine its purpose."
"I've seen those," said Merrill, like a teacher's pet. "They don't usually look like that, though."
In response, Sivius thrust his free hand into the albino's brain and pulled out another little sphere. This one lacked the tiny tentacles, and the green inside wasn't glowing.
"Here is a folly from an ordinary individual, as ordinary as the cave dwellers can be said to be, at any rate."
"Yeah, what's with those guys?" asked Merrill. "They say hello, by the way."
Sivius sniffed in contempt. It put all of Thaddeus's best sneers to shame.
"They oppose the world's new order, but lack the courage to take up the struggle. Instead, living a pathetic life of cowardice, huddled in the dark. They are worthless."
"Still, nice to have some quiet neighbours for once," sighed Mrs. Sivius.
"From the moment an adventurer shows the symptoms of the syndrome, the chloroform's folly inside their head mutates. It extrudes rudimentary limbs that lodge themselves in surrounding brain tissue. Any attempt to remove the object results in death."
Mrs. Sivius brushed aside a few giblets and set down a tray bearing cups of tea and a plate of biscuits.
"Course, we're not 100% sure if it's the removal of the thing that kills them or the state he leaves the brain in while he's trying to get it out."
"So it's some kind of symbiote?" asked Merrill, a former evil scientist's assistant, talking shop with another evil scientist.
"Parasite would be a better word," said Sivius, nibbling severely on a digestive biscuit. "My researches indicate that the syndrome renders its victims permanently brain dead upon contraction. The folly then takes over their entire nervous systems, turning them into living puppets. When you interact with a victim of syndrome, you are addressing the entity that controls them, not the person to whom their body once belonged."
"Ugh," I said.
"So the folly takes control of them?" asked Merrill, taking the little sphere from him.
"No, not in itself. It has more in common with magical technology. It's my theory that it acts as a conduit for the instructions of the controlling entity."
"You liar," said his wife. "You know full well it was Carlos's theory."
He took that one in his stride.
"It doesn't matter who came up with the theory. The point is, I believe it's the right one to pursue."
Every time I looked at Sivius, another of the dreadful, blood-soaked stories of genocide and grotesque experimentation screamed at me from inside my head. Instead, I concentrated on the tea and biscuit he was holding.
"So deleters are controlling people," I said. "What for?"
"With no way to communicate directly with the beings you call deleters, all we can do is speculate. The possessed adventurers make no attempt to seize power or gather intelligence, so invasion isn't the motive. All they seem to want to do is adventure, But if we follow that line of thinking, it leads us to the inescapable conclusion that...
That the infusion was orchestrated by these beings for no better reason than to make our world ideal for adventuring, said Sivius and his wife in unison. A place where quests never end and everyone gets a turn to complete them. You make this exact same speech to everyone we enlist, said Mrs. Sivius.
So, snapped the Baron, it's a good speech. Does the job.
I really don't want to get involved in any of this, I said, their horrifying use of the word enlist having only just sunk in. I'm looking for the deleters so I can stop having to live for any longer.
Why are you staring at my teacup?
I jumped. Sorry, sir.
If you merely wish to find the deleters, that we can help you with. Magic analysis has led us to conclude that all of these spheres are sending and receiving invisible messages to and from a specific location in the world. The origin of all the deleters' influence, which I have called the Nexus.
That name was Carlos's idea, too, whispered Mrs. Sivius into my ear.
Assist us with our goal, and in return, we will provide you with its exact location.
Assist you how? Said Merrill. Is it supposed to do that? She held out her palm. The green colour had vanished from the folly, leaving a featureless black pearl. The tentacles hung off it like limp noodles. Sivius snatched it from her.
What did you do?
Nothing, I was just holding it.
Sivius placed it under a magical analysis device he had set up on the workbench. It was the same model as the one from my old university lab, but presumably wasn't crusted with dried bodily fluids from years of creative hazing rituals.
It's dead, he announced. It's lost connection to the Nexus.
I'm sorry, sorry, said Merrill fretfully. Shall I pay for it?
Don't worry about it, love, said Mrs. Sivius, patting her maternally. We've got loads.
The mutated follies are unbreakable. I've never seen any stimuli cause them to change in any way.
The Baron tapped his chin. It tinged metallically.
James, you take one.
He grabbed a small blood-stained tray of the things from another workbench and held it out as if offering around nibbles at a party. I took one, and it almost immediately clouded over with blackness, like ink being dropped into coloured water.
"Hey, it happened much faster with him," said Merrill. Then she looked at me. "Jim, what's the matter?"
I couldn't look away from the little black ball. Something inside it screamed tinnily, as if from far away, then was cut off by a harsh crack. The tentacles stood on end. I could feel the deleter thing inside my mind shuddering, as if in pain, before it gave in and flashed something new before my eyes. From William Williams to Donald Sunderland, subject re forward account probs.
Kay, stop worrying.
From Donald Sunderland to William Williams, subject forward account probs.
Dub, I'm at the airport on one of those coin-op internet terminals. Look after this plebs issue ASAP, and don't let Simon do anything stupid while I'm on vacation. The doctor says I can't have any stress.
From Puss Monkey to support, subject account probs.
Hey, guys, one of the cars on my account isn't working anymore. What's up with that? Login whack-back-boggart name Drilder. Peace, Todd.
I was stirred from my reverie by the unique sound of Merrill snapping her half-skeletonized fingers.
Jim, she said, checking my pupils. Where'd you go?
Baron Sivius was seated at a workbench, scribbling madly with a large feather pen upon an ornate sheet of vellum scroll. The man's commitment to tradition was nothing short of applaudable.
I observe that the activated folly reacts extremely negatively to the touch of Dreadgrave's free-willed undead,
he read aloud as he wrote. You could use their actual names, said Mrs. Sibius, who was standing over him. They're not adventurers, you know. They're actual people with feelings.
Comma, James and Merrill, continued Sibius, pretending he wasn't listening and was going to add that anyway. This calls for an opening of a fresh line of inquiry. I theorize that the spheres have some close connection to, perhaps powered by, the presence of life. The same corruption of life that powers James and Merrill may be spreading to whatever magic technology exists within the sphere.
I don't really like corruption. It implies that there's something wrong with them. He smacked himself in the face in irritation. His signet ring clattered loudly against his mask.
They've both been dead for 6 decades and they're walking around. That strikes me as pretty damn wrong.
I, meanwhile, was debating with myself whether or not to reveal to the bickering magic resistance the details of the deleter correspondence in my head. There was no way to convince myself that it wasn't vitally relevant to their goals, but then again, the blob of amber hanging heavily in my robe pocket reminded me that Mr. Wonderful was going to render the goals themselves irrelevant. All I had to do was hold on long enough to learn the location of the Nexus. In the meantime, though, the mention of Drilda's name in my last vision had helped me remember something I'd been meaning to bring up. Drilda, I said. Drilda went all weird and floppy after I touched her in the dead world.
You touched her? Said Merrill, horrified. Where?
In the Applewheat battle. Mrs. Sibius chuckled to herself. I've never heard it called that before. I explained what had happened that eventful afternoon in Applewheat, how I had seen the tiny deleter inside the syndrome-inflicted Drilda, and how my touch had caused it to spaz out. I made a particular point of mentioning how I had lumped Drilda halfway across Garethy at my own pointless expense, in the increasingly futile hope that she might eventually prove useful.
"Where is she now?" asked Sibius. "It would be useful for me to examine her."
"I bet it would," said Mrs. Sibius. I got the impression that she and Captain Scar would have gotten on extremely well. "Slippery John knows where she is," I said.
"Yes, where is Slippery John?" asked Mrs. Sibius. "He was supposed to be the one to bring you in."
A pause. "Why are you looking at each other like that?" Sensing that he could seize an opportunity to be the centre of attention, Slippery John the Rabbit peered out from Merrill's neckline, snuffling at the air. I meaningfully jerked my head towards it.
"Oh, sorry, love, didn't know that was in there," said Mrs. Sibius. "I thought you were just a bit fat."
"I don't understand," said the Baron. "Is that his rabbit?"
Once again I found myself exhaustively providing exposition, explaining exactly the circumstances by which Slippery John had been transformed into a rabbit. This time I placed particular emphasis on how it would be extremely unfair to describe it as my fault.
"You're saying," said Baron Sibius, in a deadpan voice that put all of mine to shame, "that a basic bunny morph spell, acquired from a franchised magic shop, has maintained a transformation for over 4 hours.
"Ooh," said Mrs. Sibius. "Well done, you. Have you considered taking it up competitively?"
I got the feeling that the Baron was having trouble believing me, and he was waiting for me to give him the actual justification for bringing an adorable fluffy animal into his presence and undermining his entire image. I have noticed that being undead sort of amplifies the effect of my magic.
Yes, the Sibius effect. I know of it,
They named it after me. That wouldn't account for an extended transformation of this length.
"Hang on, loves," said Mrs. Sivius. She had been poking around in a nearby filing cabinet and had produced one of those vellum scrolls. "I know something like this came by once. Why do you always write everything on scrolls? It's such a nuisance to sort through. What's wrong with pages?"
"I like everything to be neat and together," said Sivius, drumming his fingers on a table.
"They have these things now called staples. Wouldn't hurt to not be a complete Luddite, would it?"
She skimmed the contents of the scroll for a moment, then pointed triumphantly.
"Here we go. There was no official record, but 200 years ago, Rogar the Invincible reported that he bunny-morphed his assistant in a pet shop north of Deborah. The assistant wasn't recovered for 6 hours, at which point he was found in a hutch with 3 female purebred show rabbits."
"Yes, well," said the Baron, "this is a tactic well known to competitive bunny-morphers. The willingness to remain a bunny can be strong enough to overpower the reversal of the spell."
"But what could—" I began. Then I noticed that Slippery John had disappeared back inside Merrill's dress and was wriggling around in a manner that could only be described as rummaging.
"Oh, XX Super Simon XX signed in at 1:44 p.m.
"Hey, Dub, the Dubster, Tubalicious."
"Hello, Simon, how are you?"
"Is Don enjoying his holidays?"
"Probably. He stopped calling every hour."
"Spot on. Hey, speaking of Don, do you know how to work his thing?"
"What?"
"You know, his thing where you type in an NPC and it tells you where they are in Mogworld?"
Yeah, I know how to work that. And so do you, 'cause Don showed you on your first day."
"Oh, yeah."
"You do remember how to use it, right?"
"Yeah, totally."
"You must have used it if you got rid of those 3 undead, like you said you did."
"Oh, yeah, I totally did that. Never mind. Hey, I've got this great idea for the game."
Okay.
"You know how there's all these different countries and factions and junk? Why don't we just unite them all into one big one?"
"Why would we want to do that?"
"And have one big leader in charge of the whole shebang."
"Maybe you should wait until Don gets back."
"Come on, man, can't you make one decision without old tall, dark and prune-stuck-up ass holding your hand? This is a great idea, right?"
"Well, not really, no. I mean, Don made it so there'd be as many countries and factions as possible. The more conflict there is, the more quests and battles and raids."
"Come on, it'd be great. I've planned it all out, and I've even got an NPC in mind for the world leader."
"Simon, listen to me. Absolutely no, this is not going to work."
"We'll see about that."
"What does that mean? Simon? Hello?"
"Hey!"
Merrill snapped her fingers in front of my eyes.
"Stop zoning out!"
I shook my head to dispel the vision. The stuff's coming out by itself now. I don't know how to stop it. We were back on the streets of Lolied City, having stopped by the albinos to ask directions back to the surface, and had spent a short while looking for somewhere to place a rabbit so that it would swiftly not want to be a rabbit any more. We had eventually settled on the dog track. The 2 of us leant on the barrier, looking down onto the field, waiting for the race to start. Slippery John was obliviously nibbling at a daisy.
"So, working with Baron Sivius," said Merrill. "If Dreadgrave could see us now, eh?
I'm just wondering what his motives are.
I'd have thought they'd be the same as everyone else's, making everyone become mortal again."
"That's the thing, isn't it? He's always been immortal anyway."
"Then I guess he just misses being special. Anyway,
We're really making progress now. We'll have that infusion down before you know it.
Another vision of Mr. Wonderful flashed through my mind's eye. This time he was picking bits of children out of his teeth. Merrill, there probably won't be anything we can do about the infusion. Let's just focus on getting me deleted.
Wouldn't you like to die with the knowledge you did something truly selfless to help your fellow man before you left?
I imagined another possible future. This time I saw a colossal statue of myself with devil horns and a diabolical sneer. The pedestal had once borne the words, "The Great Betrayer," but was now unreadable beneath several layers of rotten fruit, dung, and bodily fluids hurled by passers-by. I was the adversarial figure of a new global religion that would exist for the rest of eternity, possibly worshipping Thaddeus as the Messiah. "I won't care, because I'll be dead," I replied. Somewhere off to the left, a whistle blew, and we heard the thunderous noise of many absurdly skinny dogs sprinting across the track towards us. Slippery John, meanwhile, had rolled onto his back and was twitching his paws, possibly in expectation of a cuddle. "Well, that's about as undesirable a situation a rabbit could possibly be a rabbit in," I said, as Slippery John's animal form disappeared behind various shades of stubby fur and rangy muscle. A despairing squeal was just about audible over the barking, but it was hard to tell if it had come from a rabbit or a freshly restored Slippery John.
"Wait, I think it worked," said Merrill. "Look, a scrap of black cloth just flew out."
"Let's give it a few more minutes, just in case," I said, not looking away.
"Fair enough."
She looked around.
"Hey, what's going on over there?"
I followed her pointing finger. Around the entrance of the dog track, the usual traffic of men in dirty tweed suits and flat caps was being smartened up by the presence of numerous people in bright white robes, the well-trodden muddy ground doing no favours to their pristine hems. They appeared to be handing out leaflets. I swiftly lost interest and looked back down. Ah, there we go. The dogs worked. Merrill also looked.
"A little too well, perhaps."
The dogs had quickly parted ways with Slippery John after he'd gone limp and unentertaining. They continued with the race, leaving behind what looked like an enormous badly made pancake, mingled with a few random spatterings of raw mince and a selection of black rags. "Anyone know where to find a church?" I asked aloud.
"Slippery John finds himself a little bemused by recent events," said Slippery John later. "One second Slippery John was talking to you, the next Slippery John was being torn apart by wild dogs."
We were walking along a street in one of the lower rent districts where the corpse collection points were spaced a little further apart, and the stink of rotting flesh was overpowering. Fortunately, I didn't have a nose, Merrill was used to it, and it seemed to take some time for messages to travel from Slippery John's nostrils to his brain, so none of us were affected.
"So Slippery John was a rabbit," said Slippery John. "This is completely news to Slippery John. The primal rabbit mind must obviously have taken over and made Slippery John completely unaccountable for any embarrassing things Slippery John may or may not have possibly done while in that form."
"Well, thank God for that," I muttered dryly.
"Yes, speaking of, where's that religious friend of yours? Slippery John admits he was a little nervous about introducing Sivius to that guy." "He's being held hostage by underground cave dwellers," said Merrill.
"And it's your fault," I added.
"Don't fret. Rescuing hostages is Slippery John's forte. Slippery John will get on top of that later. But in the meantime, priorities. We have to pick up the wife." "I thought you were only engaged," asked Merrill. "Slippery John found a little chapel while you were playing around with the Adventurers Guild. Really nice service. Held Drilda up with a broomstick and had someone work her mouth to do the vows. Slippery John would have invited you, Shades of Nightmare, but, you know, probably not your scene. No blood sacrifices to horrific cosmic deities or anything."
"So where did you leave her?" I asked, wanting to change the subject before Slippery John decided to tell us how he spent his wedding night.
"The usual place where you leave bodies, in a gutter." Sure enough, Drilda was slumped in a gutter outside a small adventurer's hostel in a particularly unpleasant district, mingling with a pile of local corpses. Her tanned, technically living flesh easily stood out against the alabaster white and grey-green of the genuine dead, like a peanut on a pile of rotten macaroni.
"There you are, dear," said Slippery John, hauling her onto his shoulders and tottering only slightly under the weight. "Going to meet some interesting new people. You remember these servants of darkness?"
He froze for a second.
"Hey, do you smell something?"
"Well, I didn't expect to run into you chaps again," said Benjamin.
Those were precisely our sentiments as we saw who was standing behind us, the mage whom we had last seen having unruly spells cast from his incomplete corpse. Merrill stiffened. I immediately began summoning a firebolt. Slippery John dropped into something approaching a threatening martial arts pose, with all the impact of a kitten arching its back and mewling dangerously.
"Easy there," said Benjamin. He displayed his palms in what was either a gesture of peace or the casting stance for a level 52 exploding bones curse. "I'm past all that mercenary adventuring nonsense. I've got a true calling."
He was wearing one of the pristine white robes we'd seen being modelled at the dog track. He'd shaved off his beard and sculpted his hair into the kind of oiled, presentable arrangement one assembles when being introduced to one's fiancée's parents. As I took this all in, his use of the word calling began to feel a little ominous. "What are you doing here?" I said.
"Just wanted to say hello."
He seemed perplexed by the notion that we'd hold a grudge, or expect him to hold one for our spectacular misuse of his body.
"That's what you do when you see people you know, isn't it?"
I meant, what are you doing here on this continent?
"As part of the recruitment drive. Look, have a leaflet."
There was something spacey about him, like he'd been drugged, or finally found true love somewhere where there were a lot of gas leaks.
"I was like you once, full of anger and tormented every waking second by inhuman desires to blast the flesh from the bones of my enemies."
I noticed the corner of his mouth twitch before he continued.
"But then I discovered the truth, and dedicated myself to spreading the joy."
I inspected the leaflet. It was professionally printed on glossy paper, and was headed with the words,
"It's time for the truth. It's Truth 30.
"What truth?" asked Merrill.
"Truth, capital T. The truth about the world in which we live. And by joining the world's fastest-growing religion, you can learn exactly what that truth is."
"You mean how it's being run by mystical beings who like possessing adventurers?" said Merrill. "Because we already figured that one out."
"Did we? Slippery John didn't," said Slippery John.
"Huh. That's a bit of a downer, isn't it?"
Benjamin seemed impressed.
"I see you have been privy already to some of the Lord's teachings, but it is by no means a downer, my slippery brother. Hearing the truth is what sparked this wonderful change in me. But I suspect you have more to learn, brothers and sister. If you knew the whole truth, you would understand."
I picked through the leaflet. It seemed like the standard sort of religious rhetoric, the same kind of thing I'd made a small collection of back at Dreadgrave's fortress, when I'd been trying to find the right religion for permanent death. As per usual, it made a big thing of the truth it was peddling while revealing as little of it as possible, because this sort of group generally didn't try to feed you their really mythical nonsense until your first check cleared. "Glad to hear things are looking up for you. We'll be off now," I said quickly, jerking my thumb over my shoulder, in a very obvious gesture that went completely over his head.
"That's okay. You'll learn the truth with everyone else as soon as the Lord comes," said Benjamin.
"Awesome. Well, this isn't really my scene, but I'll pass this on to a guy I know who's into this kind of thing." I made that gesture again.
"He should be coming any moment now. We went on ahead while he stopped at a rest stop for the night, but he should be along soon if he didn't set off too late in the day."
That was a new one. I frowned in confusion for a moment before a sudden, horrible realization pulled down on my stomach and pushed my eyeballs half out of my face. "This lord of yours, you wouldn't be talking about Barry, by any chance?"
"He prefers to be referred to as the Lord these days,"
said Benjamin cheerfully. "That old divine holiness, or Bazza when he's had a few."
"This is a bad thing, right?" said Merrill, taking a guess from the look on my face.
"When you say fastest growing, how fast are we talking about?" I said slowly and carefully.
"Within the last month we absorbed 55% of all worldly religions," said Benjamin casually. "Most of the nations of Garethy have already turned themselves over." I didn't catch the end of his sentence because I was running away as fast as my ratty wooden leg would allow. Now I remembered where I'd seen those white cultist robes before, that youth group that had blown up Barry's church and who'd been working for him by the time I got to Yawnbore. I'd assumed it would have taken him longer to get the world domination thing going.
"Where are you going?"
asked Merrill, when she and Slippery John had caught up and matched pace.
"Sivius's place is back that way. We have to tell him about Barry."
"Yes, yes, I know," I said quickly, slowing to a stop. "But if he's coming, then I have to make some preparations."
"What sort of preparations?" said Slippery John.
"You know, gathering reagents, upgrading the robe, magey sorts of preparations." I grabbed Merrill around the arm. "And Merrill has to get some stuff for her sewing kit."
"I do?"
I looked her in the eye as hard as I could. "Yes, Merrill, you've used most of it up keeping us all repaired, and if there's going to be a big fight, then it'll be better to be fully stocked."
"Oh, yeah, I guess that makes sense. Slippery John, you go back to Sivius, and we'll meet you there."
Slippery John didn't move. One of his eyes narrowed, and he gave me a sidelong look.
"Wait a minute. How does Slippery John know you're not thinking of running away before Barry gets here?"
"Oh, come on," said Merrill. Slippery John ignored her, keeping eye contact with me. I hesitated for a painful few seconds. Then a sudden thought ticked a few boxes in my head, and my hand flew to my pocket. "Here," I said, handing over my half of Mr. Wonderful's tracking retail. "If you have something of mine, I'll have to come back." I watched as he gave it a silent inspection, possibly assigning a monetary value in his head. "Otherwise I might lose it," I added. "Well, all right then," he said finally, pocketing it and shouldering his wife. "Doesn't hurt to give a little now and then, does it, dead man?" I watched his little black form scamper off into the shadows, open-mouthed with surprise at how easy it had been. Then Merrill plucked at my sleeve, and I immediately began fast walking in the opposite direction. The fast walk slowed down by several orders of magnitude as we neared the city walls. The streets were becoming matted with crowds. It was the first time I'd seen so many people in one place in Lolied City, people who weren't either adventurers or dead, that is. They were squeezing themselves around a snake-like train of tightly gridlocked carriages that led all the way to the Western Gate, and moving through the gathered populace only became harder when Merrill started pulling on my elbow.
"Hey, hey, hey," said Merrill. "Shops are this way."
It was probably time she knew. "We're not going to the shops."
"Well, where else do we buy things?"
"We're not going to buy things. What we're going to do is go out the city gates and start walking."
"And then what?"
"Actually, we're pretty much just going to keep doing that, probably until we reach an ocean or a big hole in the ground." Understanding finally crashed into place behind her eyes, erasing her vacant smile.
"You're going to run away. So Slippery John was right."
"I know, isn't that a frightening thought? But we don't want to be around when Barry gets here."
"There's no reason to be so scared."
"Do you ever listen to yourself? You remember what he was like in Yawnbore."
"But now we've got Sivius to protect us. He's more than a match for Barry."
"Have you seen how he looks at us? He's trying to think of the best time to get us on a slab and figure out how we work."
"Oh, he is not. And anyway, what about getting deleted?"
"I've weighed it up, and I'm prepared to put that goal on the back burner for now. Look, we'll hang out in a cave somewhere nearby and wait and see what happens. And after Barry leaves, we'll just come back. and tell Sivius we had trouble figuring out the one-way system, all right? While I was babbling, I was edging my way through the throng towards the gate. No one in the crowd seemed to be particularly concerned. Most of them were just waiting to be let by. I jumped up and down a few times to try and see what was blocking the traffic, and caught a glimpse over everyone's heads of a much livelier commotion just outside the gate. There was a mass of white clothing, and I could just make out the faint tings of finger bells. Then I jumped into someone's rear axle and bounced off onto my arse. Merrill shook herself free of my grasp. "I'm going back to them." I deflected numerous pairs of legs and pulled myself upright. Merrill's bobbing pigtails were already disappearing from view between the bored, sweaty peasants. I took another look towards the gate, but the crowd had formed a solid wall, blocking my escape. I came to a quick decision, then ran off after Merrill. Behind me, I heard the crowd moan in dismay as the western gate's portcullis thundered down. From Internal Net Security to William Williams, subject, your message has been denied. The email you sent to Brian Garrett, enclosed below, has been rejected by security filters on the following grounds. 6771.
Nice try, fat boy.
Please review the content of your message and try again. This is an automated message and no reply is necessary, although computers do sometimes like being appreciated too. Loincloth Entertainment, Internal Net Security. From William Williams to Brian Garrett, subject Simon.
Dear Mr. Garrett, this is Bill Williams from the Mogworld Project. I am writing to formally ask that Simon be removed from the project. I saw him doing something weird to the moderator tool sets he isn't supposed to be using, and I think he might be up to something. Also, I can't prove it, but I looked over his shoulder yesterday, and I'm pretty sure I caught him trying to access the internal net security protocols. I'm pretty sure you can fire him for that. Yours sincerely, William Williams, Mogworld Project, Office 418, this building.
That was quick, said Slippery John, as Merrill and I sullenly re-entered the lair of the magic resistance. Early closing, I growled bitterly.
This mortal, this Barry, said Baron Sivius, standing at full imposing height and going over a few scrolls while his wife and Slippery John lay drilled out on a slab. Is he truly as powerful as Slippery John claims? From whence did he come?
He was a nobody vicar for some nobody religion back in Garrethy, I explained. He threw in his lot with the deleters, and for some reason they gave him huge amounts of power in return for doing little jobs for them. I explained about Yawnbore and the level of magic Barry had been showing off that had allowed him to simultaneously float a foot off the air, regenerate from any injury, maintain a magical barrier the size of an entire town, and reduce human beings to piles of dandruff.
The beings that conquered our world have chosen an avatar, a spokesman,
pondered Sivius, stroking his extruding cheekbone.
Could he be powerful enough to match even me?
Well, if you're concerned about that, maybe you could get a bit of exercise by lifting a finger to help, said Mrs. Sivius, arranging Drilda's legs. And stop stroking your extruding cheekbone, or it'll never get better.
James, there is a line of inquiry I believe you can assist with. You have had your eyes replaced with eyes from an octopus, and they are fully functional, correct?
There you go again with the stating the obvious, muttered Mrs. Sivius. It's not like he was bumping into walls the whole way here.
They're functional in the sense that I can see through them, but not in the sense of people being able to look at them without throwing up.
I am intrigued by what you told me earlier, interrupted Sivius, looming over Drilda's body and carefully caressing her face, brushing her hair behind her ears. I noticed Slippery John pout jealously. That Dreadgrave had an interest in the eyeballs of the syndrome victims. I wish to see if there has been any change in the functioning of the eyes. Since we have both a live vegetative syndrome victim and an individual with replaceable body parts, we have the opportunity to fulfill my wish. And this, incidentally, was something Carlos never thought of.
Oh, no one's impressed, said his wife.
Slippery John, who had been sitting by Drilda's bedside, fondly stroking her hand, looked up.
Hey, whoa, whoa! Unless Slippery John's grabbed the wrong end of the stick, Slippery John thinks you're talking about scooping out his beloved's eyeballs and putting them into a stanky dead guy's face. No offence.
We'll give them back when we're finished, said Merrill, already brandishing her favourite scalpel. You can keep them in a little box or something.
Slippery John's eyes narrowed. Slippery John is thinking that maybe Slippery John will take his wife away and let you find some other vegetable to mutilate.
Slippery John should consider how many kinds of torment can be explored in a single afternoon, said Sivius, without emotion.
Slippery John has decided to be amenable, said Slippery John, without skipping a beat. As long as you give them a bit of a polish afterwards and spray them with something that smells nice.
He took a rather hasty step back.
Wait, I said. You want to do this right now?
Is there somewhere you need to be? Asked Sivius.
But what about Barry? He could be here any day now. We have to prepare.
His unmasked eye met mine, and I felt the bottom drop out of several of my internal organs.
I was the Lord of the Malevolans. The very essence of dark magic is a plaything in my grasp. If there truly is an individual in this world who can match my power, then no amount of preparation can save us.
Well, okay then, I squeaked.
I lay on the slab. Everything had been black since Merrill had levered out my octopus eyes with a pencil. I'd been listening to fumbling, grotesque surgical noises and Mrs. Sivius scolding her husband for close to half an hour.
"Nearly ready," said Merrill, close to my ear. "Sorry, Drilda's eyeballs are being a bit stubborn. You'd almost think they weren't designed to pop out."
"Ha ha," I muttered. I heard a musical twanging sound, the crash of a metal implement being dropped on a tray, and Sivius hissing a dreadful curse.
"And one of them just rolled under a desk. Sorry. You've got to expect some teething troubles when you're on the cutting edge of scientific discovery."
"There you are," came Mrs. Sivius's voice. "Just brush the fluff off and we're ready to go."
I felt pincers worrying at my optic nerves, prompting a few sparks and whooshes before my vision. Then a pair of warm, wet blobs sank into my eye sockets.
"What do you see?" asked Merrill.
"The inside of my head."
"Oh, sorry."
She carefully rotated the eyeballs.
"How about now?"
My vision focused quickly. The patchy, broken ceiling of the cathedral returned to view, along with the flaking paintings of beautiful naked angels left by a long-dead artisan who didn't get out enough. Something had changed now, though. My vision was absolutely perfect. The colours seemed to glow with increased vibrancy. Even Baron Sivius seemed to have a bit more rosiness in his cheeks. I looked at the Baron again. Then I sat bolt upright.
"What is it?"
he asked, expertly disguising his startled jump as an incidental little tick.
"What do you see?"
"Words!"
"Words?"
I waved at a point about 1 foot above his scalp. "There are words over your head!" I looked around. "Over everyone's heads!" They were in bright orange serifed lettering, as if stamped by some great cosmic movable type. And it seemed that wherever I positioned my head, the words rotated to face me, creating the disquieting impression of being scrutinized by language. Slippery John's words simply read, "Slippery John." The Baron's was also his name, but underneath was the word "Boss" in smaller lettering. Mrs. Sivius's label bore her maiden name, which I won't repeat, but gave a good indication of why she was eager to relinquish it. And Merrill's read "Lord Dreadgrave's Undead Minion." I relayed all of this to my colleagues.
"Fascinating," said Sivius,
as the others began carefully pawing the air above them.
"The entities that control the syndrome victims appear to be employing some kind of sophisticated intelligence-gathering magitechnology. What else is there?"
"There's this thing floating in the corner of my vision," I said, reaching out a hand and trying in vain to touch it. "It's like a red bar with words around it, and..." I stopped. I'd just looked at Drilda. There was something wrong with the label above her head. It was meaningless gibberish, a string of flickering punctuation marks that constantly changed. Then it began to expand, growing beyond the confines of the space above her head, bleeding into the room. I jumped back to escape the deluge of hyphens and question marks, but they moved with me. They weren't in the room, I realized. They were overlaid onto my eyes, and there was no escape. Soon I couldn't see anything but oceans of meaningless orange punctuation. I felt myself trip on something and collapse to the ground. Then a string of gibbering exclamation marks tunneled their way into my brain, and the world fell away into void.
"You there?"
Sunderwonder is currently away. He may not reply to your messages.
"Do talk to me, please. This is really important."
Sunderwonder is currently away. He may not reply to your messages.
"I don't know how he did it, but Dickface has hacked the net security, so I can't send emails."
Sunderwonder is currently away. He may not reply to your messages.
"And now he's taken away my Mogworld admin tools."
Sunderwonder is currently away. He may not reply to your messages.
"He's messing around with the build, and I can't do anything to stop him, and I think I'm about to start crying."
Sunderwonder is currently away. He may not reply to your messages.
"Yeah, here I go."
"Lord Dreadgrave's undead minion, signed in at 4:14 p.m.
"Is that you, Don?"
"What?"
"Is that you, Don?"
"What?"
"Why do you keep saying what?"
"You can hear me?"
Yes. Who is this?"
"I don't know what's happening. My name's Jim. They put Drilda's eyes in my head and now I'm here."
"It says you're coming from inside our main server. Are you a player?"
"No, I'm a mage. I'm an undead mage. I don't see any servers here, or any kind of waiting staff. It's just a big black space."
"Wait, did you say Drilda? Are you the guy who had the account probs?"
"I don't have an account. There weren't any banks near my farm. I kept all my money in a tin under my mattress. Why are you asking these stupid questions?"
"What do you mean? Who are you?"
"Oh, God. I figured it out. You're one of them, aren't you?"
"What?"
"You're a deleter."
"What?"
You're one of those things that take over the adventurers.
Whoa. Are you an NPC?
Why can't you talk properly?
Oh, man. Are you seeing this, Don? I so-called this.
Sander Wanda is currently away. He may not reply.